wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora.
Kia
Hopefully that's
ora.
Not going to go
no.
into the outro. I just realised that was on order.
Look at that, it's all working.
Okay, should be good to go. Kia ora, how are you going today, Alan?
Yeah, it's warming up, isn't it? I like that. I like that summer is on its way by the feel of it. So, yes.
Right on. It's beautiful weather at the moment.
And Mr. Whippy's outside.
So. Shout out anyone on here.
There we
Mr.
go.
Mr. Whippy seems to be around a lot.
Summer must be here.
Haven't seen that in 10 years, 5 years.
Right on. We've got a few cool topics with us today. The first relates to Nobel Prizes. Episode to Alfred himself.
Let's milk these for all they're worth, because why not? But it just so happens to be Alfred Nobel's birthday today, which is kind of cool.
How old would he be?
He would be old.
He was
born in 1833.
Oh, that is old.
So, I thought he was like 1900s or something.
Yeah, no. He never made it to the 20th century, died in 1896. But he was born this day in 1833 in Stockholm, Sweden, which kind of explains a few things as to why they always hold the ceremonies in Sweden.
Yes.
And so that very year that he was born, his father, Emmanuel, unfortunately went bankrupt, which kind of sucked. And so his father had to go to St. Petersburg in Russia without the rest of the family. And over in Russia, he worked on landmines and sea mines.
I see.
So explosives and stuff like that, with great success, so much so that a few years later, the rest of the family moved to St. Petersburg and they had the big reunification and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So Alfred sort of grew up in Russia, sort of his formative years of schooling and stuff like that. And then at age 17 in 1850, as a result of all this good schooling, he now speaks five languages. Five languages. Yeah.
Pretty epic.
And he thought, nah, bugger it, I'm off to Paris for a year and I'll go and work in a chemistry lab down in Paris. And then he ended up going to Italy and Germany and the USA. So he's sort of traveling around as you do and you know.
Yeah.
And then in 1856, disaster struck. Because peace broke out.
Peace broke out, yes.
The Crimean
How
War.
Tragic.
Wow.
The Crimean War. Okay, so the Russians were busy buying up these landmines and sea mines from Nobel's dad.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden the Crimean War finished in 1856 and the Russian orders kind of dried up because they had nobody to fight against.
Oh, I see.
So Emmanuel's company went bankrupt again. So the family was in a bit of shtum at that stage. And so Alfred sort of thought, oh, I did some stuff in Paris when I was working in there. I did this experiments with this stuff called nitroglycerin. Mm-hmm. And he was thinking, oh, well, this could be a good new explosive. And so in 1862, he starts work himself on nitroglycerin, trying to sort of save the family and everything. And in 1863, he moves back to Stockholm and he patents nitroglycerin as an explosive. Mm-hmm. And then the year after that, he invents a blasting cap so that, you know, one of those things you hit it and it goes bang, or you heat it up and it goes bang and everything. So that's a way to trigger the explosions and stuff. It seems all nice and safe. That same year, unfortunately, his brother Emil was killed in a nitroglycerin explosion in a sort of a shed type thing. So
that's unlucky.
So that wasn't good. So, he was sort of working on that as well. And so what Alfred really then wanted to do was to try and make it safer. And so he started on this, and then a couple of years later there was a factory that they had a big explosion in Germany. He'd moved there and the factory went up, and so he's thinking, no, we've got to make this stuff safer. You know, there's too much of this going on. And what he found was that mixing nitroglycerin with a thing called diatomaceous earth, which is just silica, basically. It's just silica deposits on, it's sort of like sand, sort of.
Okay.
So you mix it with this, and it stabilizes it. And like nitroglycerin itself, it's really sensitive. You can just drop it or hit it or shock it and everything. It's just totally unpredictable. It'll just go bang on you, okay? So he made this safe and he made it predictable, and that was his path to fortune and fame. And so he called the stuff dynamite and he patented it in 1867 and he made a fortune, absolute fortune. So he ended up owning 16 factories in 14 countries.
Right.
Okay.
So this leads into how he's become kind of the name of this big prize
indeed.
For all of these scientific discoveries that we have today.
Right, absolutely. So he's doing pretty well for himself. Mm-hmm. And so he's getting a bit older. And then in 1895, he decides he'd better write a will. And so he does this, which is just as well, because he died the next year.
Oh, yeah.
In Italy, in San Remo, Italy, where he'd moved. And the first Nobel Prizes were announced on the 10th of December 1901, and that just happened to be the day that he died in 1896 on the December the 10th. So it took 5 years. And so basically what he said in his will was that he wanted to create, quote, a fund, the interest on which is to be distributed annually as prizes to those who, during the preceding year, have conferred the greatest benefit to humankind.
Yeah.
Okay. And he specified five disciplines for these awards. So physics, chemistry, physiology or medicine, one, literature and peace.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, people are saying that he probably had, he probably felt bad about the fact that he'd sort of brought explosives into the mainstream and stuff and everything. And so this is why
he needed a peace prize.
This is why he funded a peace prize. He also had a very, very sort of dear friend, Beata von Suttner, who was a big peace activist.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of her.
You've heard of her? Some of you may know that there's also an economics prize, but that's not really a Nobel Prize because that was done by the Bank of Sweden in 1968.
Right.
And okay. So it doesn't really count as a real Nobel Prize. They call it inspired by Nobel or something like that. But in terms of money, how much money have we got? When he died, his will was worth about $232 million in today's dollars. So,
whoa.
So it's the interest on that funds the Nobel Prizes.
Oh, so it's still going from...
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Wait, that's
so cool. Okay.
And so the awards themselves are worth around about $1 million US each
at
the moment. So, you know, that's going to be costing $5 million a year. So, he's, you know, they're easily getting the interest of $5 million a year.
Yeah, that's a crazy legacy.
And so it's an amazing legacy, and it's, you know, it's the most well-known sort of scientific prize and literature and peace. You know, it really does create a stir around this time of the year, with good reason. And you know, you hope that the correct people are honoured. Sometimes they are. Mostly they are. Sometimes they're not. The guy who invented the frontal lobotomy, for example, won the Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine.
Oh,
yes.
Wow. Well,
and Henry Kissinger got the Peace Prize, let's not forget. But,
God.
Yeah.
You get some interesting nominations for that one.
Oh, and there's going to be lots of people nominating a certain orange person next year.
I was thinking that.
You just know that's going to be the case.
Anyway, if you want to check out who won the Nobel Prizes, we talked about it a bit last week on our episode, but they're also available on the website. The next story that you've got is about maths in science.
There's plenty of that, isn't there?
Yeah, of course. There's definitely a Venn diagram of maths.
Okay, the most useless thing I've been taught in my life,
come on.
Are Venn diagrams.
Venn diagrams, don't hate on a Venn
useless.
Diagram.
It depends.
God, we had them every year in primary school. Venn diagram this, Venn diagram that.
It's a great way to
understand
things.
Oh my God, it's totally useless.
Well, I can't believe you're a Venn diagram hater.
No,
having a
no,
debate.
Absolutely.
Okay,
awful.
Let's talk
come
about
on, let us know what
about.
You think. Come on. What do you think on Venn diagrams?
I'm on the fence, so I'm just going to sit this one out.
You're the intersection of the
Venn diagram. Yeah, I'm in the middle. Actually, I'm in the middle of the Venn diagram.
Yes.
It's like one ends. Do you hate them? Do you like them? In the middle, that's me. In the middle.
All right.
Anyway, back to what we were going to talk about, which is stalagmites.
Yes.
Stalactites and stalagmites. Remember them?
I was going to say, this is another thing I remember from primary school. It's a C, stalact, C for the ceiling, and then G for the ground.
There
yes, I got it. I saw
it.
It.
Well
yeah,
done.
Yeah.
Well
stalag
done.
Of ground,
no
stalag ceiling. Yeah.
There we go. So you go into a cave and you see these things coming down from the ceiling or growing up from the ground. The stalactites are coming down from the ceiling and the stalagmites are coming up from the ground.
Yes.
Well
yes,
done, Faith.
Yeah.
Good,
nice.
good. And So they do kind of look different if you've spent any time in caves, which I haven't really, but you see that some of them look all nice and sharp and pointy sometimes, or they're big flat and sort of, you know, broad and everything like that. So some people in Poland and Slovenia and the States thought, well, why is this? Why do they look different? And particularly the stalagmites are the ones that we're interested in, okay? And the stalagmites, how are they formed? And they're formed from dripping water, basically.
Okay.
And they're dripping water that is saturated with carbon dioxide and carbonate, okay? So essentially what they are is just essentially calcium carbonate, okay? And we're just getting these drips of water that contain this calcium carbonate, and they just drip and they just drip and drip and drip. And eventually, over squillions of years, these stalagmites grow up from the ground up, you know, et cetera, yeah. et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I see.
And so they were, yeah, they asked this question, why are some of them nice and pointy? Why are them some got flat tops and they're big and broad and et cetera, et cetera? And it all comes down to maths. And so there's a 60-year-old mathematical model of stalagmite growth. And these workers in Poland and Slovenia and the States, and they've sort of they've figured it out, basically. And what they've found is that the shape of the stalagmite that you get is essentially dependent on the rate at which the water is dripping. Oh. Okay, so it's drip, 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 drip. So what you get when you've got relatively fast dripping water, that gives you the nice pointy cone-shaped stalagmites. Okay. Now, if you get slow drips, and as long as they go on the same spot, which they may or may not, okay, so if you get slow drips, you get big, thick columns. Okay. And if you get drips from very, very high, okay, because you're going to be dripping different distances as well, because sometimes you just have a stalactite on the roof and there's a couple of centimetres and it's dripping down onto a stalagmite, you know.
Right.
So that's not dripping very far. But if they're dripping very high, or they're dripping in different spots, then that gives you the big flat tops and the big broad everything and stuff. And they sort of thought, okay, well, let's test this out. So we've solved the mathematical equations. Let's test this out. So they went to a cave in Slovenia, very famous cave. And what they found was very, very good agreement between what they saw in the cave and what they were calculating using the maths, which is, you know, is kind of nice. And you might think, you know, big whoop, dibbly, dibbly do, whatever. But this could have applications in figuring out sort of climate change and stuff like that, because, you know, caves are sort of nice, undisturbed places, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And you can sort of, in the same way they say as tree rings give you data about the climate, then perhaps a similar sort of thing can happen with stalagmites as well, and that could give you some sort of handle on what was going on with the climate at any particular time. So,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of nice stuff. So.
That's very cool to for them to have worked that out.
Yeah, that's
very interesting, actually.
Yeah.
Your final topic here is about a telescope.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I can't say much more about that. A sharpened telescope vision.
Yeah.
Take it away, Alan.
So this is the James Webb Space Telescope, which was launched a few years ago now, and that was to replace the Hubble Space Telescope.
Yeah.
Which I'm guessing you've heard of.
No,
my goodness, okay. So the Hubble telescope was sort of this first major telescope that was put up up in space so that it didn't have to go through the Earth's atmosphere. So this was a big deal, because you get all sorts of aberrations and stuff with temperature gradients in the Earth's atmosphere, et cetera, and that just sort of ruins the pictures. So you get out of that and you get amazing pictures. And so the Hubble Space Telescope went up, I think sort of early 90s, I think, late 80s, early 90s, there or thereabouts. And immediately it looked something was wrong. And something was wrong, that they'd made all the mirrors and everything for the telescope sort of correctly, but they'd put them in the wrong place or some weird thing. And they were only by a tiny, tiny, tiny amount.
Yeah, but it makes all the difference.
But it did make all the difference, and it was all sort of blurry and stuff. And what they had to do was a special space shuttle operation, which was to go up there and basically they had to put glasses on it, basically.
Yeah.
And then they get all these amazing photos. Now, sort of the same thing is happening with this James Webb Space Telescope. that, you know, initially everything sort of looked, sort of okay, but they sort of thought, well, it's not as good as it should look, and it's a bit blurry and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so what they were finding was that there was a problem. And so we talk about pixels on a screen. So the detector that is used in this telescope, you know, is made up of pixels.
Yeah.
And
okay.
So what they found was that when a pixel was lit up, it would sometimes bleed over into the next door pixel if that wasn't lit up.
Oh, okay.
So you were sort of getting bleeding.
Yeah, that's tricky.
And that wasn't good. And what they couldn't do then was to send up somebody and fix it. Because the Hubble telescope was in orbit around the Earth, so they just had to, you know, send a space shuttle up and they're away. The James Webb is about 1.5 million kilometres away from Earth. Yeah, can't very easily send somebody up to do some maintenance on that. So these Australian folk thought, oh, we can fix this, and we'll use AI to fix this. And
oh,
so,
no.
And they did. Okay, and so what they did was to... basically replicate the camera on Earth, essentially, and then they knew what the pictures should look like that were being taken by the telescope, and then they could sort of train their system to, or train their software to make those changes during the image processing.
Oh, okay? Clever.
So they're not sort of putting a lens in front of the mirrors to actually fix the picture that you're getting. They're treating the data that has been collected and then making it look better, essentially making it look like it should, and getting rid of the blur and everything. And so they've just published this as a preprint a couple of weeks ago, and you know, this is pretty astonishing stuff that people just sort of said.
Yeah,
in Australia.
That's amazing. That's a great use of technology.
Yeah. So this is good use of AI.
Yeah, exactly. Read my mind. That's a way that AI can be good.
Yes. Oh no. Of course it can, but it can also be not good as well.
See, these are the things that it should be used for. Just the more technical stuff.
Science.
Like, exactly, yes. Science. I don't think it's, look at this pretty painting that AI did for me. I'd see, but if it's science, yes.
Or you could maybe have a president of a certain country dropping fecal material on people.
Oh, yeah, Elon Musk and the
president.
The AI videos of them dancing together. Yeah.
You haven't seen the one of Trump in a plane, obviously.
Oh, I probably have, yeah.
Oh, my God, it's scary.
And I don't know if I want to see that.
And that's what some people are using AI for now. Anyway.
That was a great note to end, dear science. Thank you so much for sharing all your topics, Alex. Yes, thank you as always to MOTAT, and thank you, Science. That is the show for today.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.